Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Is it possible to have an orgasm after you die? What's it like to use the bathroom in space? Did constipation really kill Elvis Presley? Those are just a few examples of the sorts of quirky but fascinating question today's guest, Mary Roach, likes to tackle. Mary is one of the most compelling and certainly one of the funniest science writers working today, and she has an uncanny ability, this is no excuse, an uncanny ability to uncover some really oddball research and oddball scientists who are doing it. She's also the person who delivered one of the most popular TED Talks of all time, which is called 10 Things You Didn't Know About Sex, and I think it's at 12 million views and counting. Mary and I have corresponded for years, but this is the first time we've met face-to-face, and I'm absolutely delighted to have her as a guest. So welcome.
Thank you.
So, your latest book is called Gulp, and it's all about the human digestive system, but I have lots of questions about that, including what you learned about the role digestive trouble played in Elvis's death, I think back in 77, if I remember properly. But let's talk about some of the other questions. First of all, is it possible to have an orgasm after you die?
Yes, it is.
And how can that be?
Yes, because orgasm is a reflex, like sacral nerve reflex. So if you had somebody who was brain dead, in other words, they're brain dead, but they're being kept alive and their body is being kept functioning on a respirator, so everything is being oxygenated, there's blood supply, you're legally dead because your brain dead. So you have this dead person with their body viable, all the organs are being served and all the tissues. So if you stimulated the right place on the spinal nerve or even in the brain, you would trigger that reflex. You wouldn't enjoy it in the same way that you would when you were alive, but yeah, it is a possibility. Yes, absolutely, that you could.
And how do we know this? Has research of this sort?
Well, as far as I know, it's all theoretical. Okay. I don't know of anybody. I was talking about this with a spinal cord researcher in Alabama, and she said, "You try to get the funding for that study."
Right. Yeah.
So no, nobody's actually. Well, that I know of has tried it.
But speaking of kind of offbeat or research that might raise some eyebrows, there is a lot of research done on cadavers, human cadavers,
yeah.
Right? What sorts of things do human cadavers do in studies?
Well, generally speaking, cadavers are brought in to test things that you couldn't test on a live human because you would harm them. So cadavers have this kind of superpower in that they don't feel any pain and they don't care what you do to them. So they tend to be things like testing protective gear, like athletic equipment, face guards, bulletproof garments, or automotive safety. They've been used a lot in testing, in car crash safety and in figuring out how, the dummies, you can use a dummy, but first you have to calibrate it. So they use the cadavers to figure out, all right, that much force, what would it do? Break the ribs? Would it shear the aorta? Would it be a fatal injury or would it be something you could recover from? So they need the actual bodies to figure out what this force does, what that force would do. So the dummy's just going to tell you the force, and then you need to figure out, is that dangerous?
Well, not to be too gruesome about it, but what are we talking about literally with these these cadavers are used in that kind of crash testing research?
Well, it's usually something like I spent some time, it was at Wayne State University. They were doing it's a biomechanics department. So they have a guy, a dead guy in a car seat. And he's sort of in driving position, which is not that easy to get a cadaver into driving position. But anyway, so they get him set up and then they bring in, it's just an impactor and that it's just a piston comes out and hits him in the shoulder. And that is simulating like a side impact crash at a certain speed. And then they look at what kinds of damage there is to the shoulder or the ribs. But it's not like they put him in a car and they put a plank on the gas pedal and like, let her rip.
Right.
It's not like that. It's very controlled and not particularly gruesome.
And these are, of course, people who've given their bodies permission to that while they're alive, certainly.
Yes, occasionally they are unclaimed bodies, depending on what the county decides to do with unclaimed bodies, if they're just going to incinerate them or do a kind of a potter's grave.
Right.
And sometimes they make use of them for anatomy classes and research. So it depends just on what the disposition of unclaimed bodies is.
So continuing this idea, maybe in a less gruesome way, Elvis, you write in your book Gulp about the death of Elvis, and you interview, I guess, his personal physician.
Yes.
Tell us what you learned about Elvis's death.
Well, Elvis perished of something that is, I had never heard of this before, but is apparently not that uncommon. It is called defecation-associated sudden death, and that is really somebody who is straining too hard and creates ultimately a fatal heart arrhythmia. Mm. It's a particular response that the heartbeat goes off, and it can be a fatal event. And sometimes you see heart patients in the intensive care unit that are on stool softeners for this very reason, because they're using a bedpan, their hearts are not strong, and they don't want them to get defecation-associated sudden death. Anyway, so indirectly, constipation killed Elvis, because right. he had a megacolon. He had a very, very oversized, blocked, dysfunctional colon, a particular stretch of it. And that's something some people have from childhood. His doctor didn't know whether he'd had that since childhood. He asked Priscilla, right. And she didn't wish to answer these questions.
But so he, in the book, you describe how his doctor kept enemas and tried to keep Elvis going during his concerts, but he had huge weight fluctuations, right? I mean, it's kind of disgusting, but it's interesting too, right?
Yeah, he would become very backed up because he had this dysfunctional colon. He'd become, and people would comment about how he appeared to be losing or gaining 10 pounds of weight from one day to the next. And Dr. Nicopoulos was saying that was sometimes just when he finally managed to go. It was a dramatic right. effect. And yeah, they would travel with like boxes of Fleet's enemas. Mm-hmm. And it was a very sad story. It was plus the drugs. The drugs weren't helping, because particularly things like pain relievers slow down or stop
right.
the motions of the gut. So that's contributing absolutely to it. But he seemed to have a condition beyond just the effect of the drugs.
Right. So he didn't, I guess, with this megacolon, basically he had this kind of paralyzed stretch of colon, right? Mm-hmm. Or, the colon
right.
has this peristaltic
right.
process. It's rhythmic contractions which push
right.
stool through the colon or
right.
push digested food.
Right.
Right. So my question is, tell us about that process. Can you walk us through the mm-hmm. whole digestive process? I mean, I think people understand you eat some food, it goes in the stomach, and so on.
Yeah, you eat some food. You process it orally. You form a bolus, which is my new favorite word. So you chew it. You take the food apart, chew it up, put it back together with saliva in the shape that will fit down easily. You swallow it, goes into the stomach. Stomach breaks it down further with acids and enzymes, and also by kind of kneading it. The stomach is sort of a muscular sac. And when it's in a slurry or liquidy state, it spurts it into the small intestine, which is where the absorption happens. All the good nutrients get absorbed there. And then the things that we couldn't absorb, the things we couldn't use, sort of the compost pile, that goes into the colon. And the colon is what kind of dries out, because if it just went straight through, it would be liquid.
Right.
So it spends some time in the colon being water getting absorbed, and it dries it out and eventually makes its way. Then when you eat, it triggers a reflex where it pushes. It's called the gastrocolic reflex, where you eat and then it's kind of in with the new, out with the old. Stuff gets pushed along through the peristaltic motion that you just mentioned. So it makes its way to the rectum. At a certain point, the rectum stretches to a point where these receptors called stretch receptors tell the brain, okay, time
right.
to empty.
Right.
So that's kind of a very, very simplistic.
And a couple things were interesting to me. One, you talk about this question, I think a lot may occur to some people, which is the stomach is full of acid, so why doesn't it eat itself up? What did you learn? Tell us about that, and what else did you learn that might be surprising to our listeners?
Well, the stomach has a protective mucus layer that exists for that very reason. There's also the stomach lining regenerates quickly, apparently every 3 days. But the stomach has a bunch of protective mechanisms that are kind of amazing. It's really difficult to burst a human stomach.
Mm.
You can overeat. You can eat 18 or 19 pounds of food. There are cases, there was a case of stomach rupture where the person had actually eaten 19 pounds of food. But the reason it's hard to burst it is that it will take care of itself. It will empty itself. If you push it, again, stretch receptors, if you push it to a certain point and it knows how big it's getting, it will take emergency measures and empty itself. There's reflexive throw up.
Right. And you spoke to some competitive eaters,
yeah.
I believe. What are competitive eaters born, or do they learn their skill?
competitive eaters, they tend to be folks, they don't have a larger stomach typically, but it's more, the word is compliant. It stretches more. They have very stretchy stomachs, a lot of them. The training is, a lot of it is mental. And they practice with water, because if they practiced with food, they'd, you know, the caloric intake would be such that they'd be hugely obese, probably. So they practice getting used to the very unpleasant feeling of being overly full, and then continuing to ingest beyond the point that you really don't want to eat anymore. So, and they also, and I said, well, how do you guys get around the fact that you have this reflex safety mechanism to throw up? And they said, oh, well, we don't get around that. It happens. It's just that we just swallow it back down and keep going, which I can't even begin to imagine.
Meaning how they're throwing up during the competitions?
But they said as long as the food doesn't come out, it can come up. So it starts to come up, they swallow it back down and keep going. And that's how they get around that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're tackling these topics that a lot of people find disgusting, revolting. But the people you interview don't feel that way at all. You've interviewed a bunch of scientists who take it very seriously.
Yeah.
All this research on the, you know,
saliva, say, yeah.
Right. Or you talk about people spitting into your own food, and that grosses people out, right?
Yeah, right. Saliva is a very, it's an odd substance in that we're fine with it when it's in our mouth, and as soon as it leaves our mouth, even if it's our own. You know, there was a disgust researcher in Pennsylvania who did, UPenn, who did, he had people imagine a bowl of their favorite soup. And he said, okay, how likely would you be to consume that soup? And they'd be like, oh, scale of 1 to 10, 10. And then he said, okay, now imagine spitting into that soup. And then it goes down to like 1. And
right.
People, even though it's their own saliva, even though you're going to be mixing the soup with your saliva, people are like, as soon as it's outside the body, you know, it's an interesting kind of shift that happens.
And it only gets worse the farther down you go. On the track.
Right.
And what else did you learn in the course of researching this book that really surprised you about the human digestive tract?
Well, I was going to start out with the mouth, but I ended up including a chapter on the nose because it's so important, because it's something like 80%, when you talk about flavor, 80% of it is happening in the nose. The tongue is just sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and that other brothy one,
right.
And everything else, almost infinite variety of aromas are being processed through the nose. So it's tasting and appreciating food is much more of a nose activity than a mouth activity. You know, the chewing obviously happens in the mouth, but and we have a set of internal nostrils. That's another there. You know, you have the nostrils in your nose, but which you use by inhaling. But then there's nostrils, like an opening from the back of the mouth into the nose. And when you exhale, you're also sniffing food and smelling food. So you can appreciate food more by kind of holding it in your mouth and exhaling while it's in your mouth, which you're doing anyway when you breathe. So that was kind of surprising to me, the role of the nose. And
right. And I think you talk about this in the book also about how it can be really dangerous when someone loses a sense of smell. It makes it hard for them to keep food, to want to eat food.
Yes,
that's right.
It
destroys their appetite.
Yeah, there are people who starve to death just because they get, and that can be true if they lose the ability to taste as well. I mean, that when you lose the ability, in food tastes, what I heard, what the researcher, it was a swallowing expert, an MD, she said, you're chewing this food and your brain is telling you, this is cardboard. It's not food. Don't swallow it. This is not safe because it's not food. Don't swallow it. And it's like you gag and you don't want to swallow it. And it's, it's a horrible affliction.
Who are those patients? Who are those kind of people who have that problem?
Well, sometimes there's radiation treatment for cancer, for oral cancer can damage some of the taste receptors. Some people are, but I have a friend who lost her sense of smell. It was almost like it was a drug she was on, or I think sometimes people have sort of a spontaneous loss of smell. I don't know all the conditions that contribute to it. When you age, you lose some of your ability to taste and smell. So my father-in-law is 91. He tends to just dump a lot of hot sauce on everything.
You also talking about sense of smell and of taste. You spend time talking about scientists who develop dog and cat foods. And I guess I hadn't realized that cats don't like sweets, right? I'm a dog person.
Right, yeah.
But dogs love sweets. They'll just about anything you give to them.
Yeah.
Cats don't have interest.
They either don't interest or they don't taste it. The thing that drives cats crazy, there's something they call cat crack. It's called pyrophosphate, and it's a... I tried some in a liquid form. It has almost no taste / flavor at all. It tastes like strange. It doesn't seem like a food flavor. Certainly not one that would make you go crazy to eat this food.
But that's what cats love.
So that's a sort of a trade secret. There are different versions of these pyrophosphates that are used as coatings for kibble. I remember saying, that's sort of a mean trick. You can take this tasteless piece of soy and corn and you can coat it with something.
Right.
And they said, well, what do you think snack food is? Have you ever had a Cheeto without the coating?
Hmm.
And basically, or a piece of chicken breast without any sauce.
They're fooling us. It's
a palatant. The coating, you know, the sauce or the coating is where that gets us excited about eating it, and then a large portion of it doesn't really have much flavor at all.
Well, you also talk about the difficulty in creating a dog food. I mean, it's hard for me to believe they're still coming up with new dog foods, because it seems like they would have figured it out by now and marketed it. But that dogs like things that smell dead, basically, right? There's a gas, I believe, that gets given off by decaying bodies. And so you have this trade-off between what the dog wants to eat and what the dog's owner can stand to smell, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it works the other way as well. There may be something that the owner is like, wow, that's like barbecue. That's like cooking meat. That smells really good to me. But to the dog, who's, you know, 1,000 times as many receptors, or, you know, it comes across so intensely that it's too much. It's overwhelming and it's off-putting. So it has to be, they have to find this balance, something that will appeal to both the dog and the owner. Yeah.
Changing the dreams for a moment. Actually, I was reading a story today that talked about a snake that had been found dead with a centipede coming out of its body. And I'd never thought about that until I read your book. And tell us about that kind of controversy that's gone on for years. What's been the debate, and what's the truth about that?
Oh, well, the one that I've heard most is, and you hear about it a bunch in the herpetological community, people who have frogs and lizards as pets. There is a belief, a very common belief, that because you got to feed them live mealworms,
right?
They like to capture the food and eat it live, and there's a belief that the ones that swallow them whole, there's a belief that they can eat their way out. And there's lots of people say, "Oh, I saw my pet dead, and I saw a little worm coming out of it." And I actually spent some time with a researcher at University of Nevada who set out to debunk that. We had snakes and different kinds of snakes and lizards, because he has a whole lab. He's like, doesn't matter what he's doing, but he's got a bunch of these critters. And we had mealworms, and we put them on string and fed them, you know, kind of dragged them around and made sure that the animal ate them. And then we put an endoscope, actually designed for the urethra, so very thin endoscope, down the throat, and watched what was going on in the stomach when the mealworm was in there. And it very quickly stops moving and is motionless. We probably looked at 7 or 8 or 9 mealworms in stomachs. None of them were doing anything resembling, not even squirming around after the first couple of seconds, and nobody was trying to eat their way out.
Right. So nothing
is eating. No. I mean, my feeling, and everybody who was there, their feeling was that there's just no way. And why would they have that behavior? Why would they know to start eating? You know, that was... anyway, but it persists. And even though this research was done, there's still people that go, no, I saw it. But one of the things with these mealworms, they like to burrow underneath and get out of the light. So they would be under... So say you had a dead animal,
right,
and you had mealworms, they would tend to be under, you know, tucked under, and you might at a glance think it was sticking out. And that's what had happened, and that's why the animal died. And there are people who, no matter what you do or say, they believe that they have seen it. But it's usually, I have a friend who saw.
Right.
That's
always
happen.
The case, right? It's always the
yeah.
case. So another, talking about reptiles again, you write, there's a part of your book you talk about the possibility, the scientific basis for the dragon myth, right?
Fire-breathing dragon.
So tell us about that. So you're going to explain to us how it came up, how dragons came to be.
This is a theory. Stephen Secor, who's a snake physiologist at the University of Alabama, had this idea. He Doesn't matter. He was doing. It doesn't matter how he came to this, but it was he was studying some. He does a lot of work with digestion and, of snakes. Snakes tend to snakes swallow fairly large prey items whole, and they sit there for quite a while, being broken down inside the snake. And as they break down, like any breakdown product, there's a lot of gas released, a lot of hydrogen, and there's a spike in hydrogen at a certain point. And he was thinking. Imagine a scenario where somebody kills a snake to eat, you know, early man, drags it back to the fire, sets it down around the time that the spike in hydrogen is taking place inside the snake. Now somebody else comes along, isn't looking, steps on, I love the notion of clumsy cavemen, coming along, steps on the snake, blows the hydrogen out, the fire right there ignites the hydrogen, and there you go, you have a snake that suddenly exhaled fire. So that was a theory.
Is there any more evidence for this kind of a theory?
No, just that he looked at the places that you first hear about the myth of the fire-breathing serpent tended to be places that have these enormous snakes that, you know, would have provided a good meal. So,
well, where are these places? I think of medieval Europe. So, but you're talking.
We'd have to open the book. And okay. It was like I thought it was somewhere in Asia. There were a couple of places, but yes,
and
Europe as well. I would guess
fire breathing
dragon.
Right. So let me ask you also about another part of the book I found very interesting, which is makes me a little bit squeamish to talk about. Perhaps I don't think you are. I don't think of anything that makes you squeamish. But that is, you talk about the rectum. You talked about that before, the stretch receptors and so on.
Yeah.
And you talk about how common it is for convicts to smuggle, or their family members, I guess, to smuggle contraband into prison. I don't know, like,
yes,
out of prison,
yeah,
in their colons or in their rectums.
Uh-huh.
And you said it's so common, in fact, that, and I found this hard to believe, but you tell me this is real, it's that the colon is called the prison wallet.
It's so common. I saw security camera footage from the visitor's room. It's usually a family member hands something off to their loved one who's in prison. And in order to get it into the prison, if it's drugs or money or a cell phone, things that aren't allowed in the prison, you'll just, you're watching this video camera footage and the person just kind of is having a conversation, leans back as though he's putting a handkerchief in his pocket. It takes maybe 3 seconds. He's just reaching down his prison uniform and putting it up there without changing his expression. I mean, it's that easy. It's not an unusual or extreme thing to do. It's so common. It's like flossing your teeth. It's nothing. It is so commonly done they are searched. So you definitely have to be adept at getting it up there high enough to get past the visual. It's a visual inspection, you know, bend over and spread kind of thing.
Right. And so, how do prison guards find that? I mean, if it's really inside
They often don't find it. You know, I think it's bend over and cough, which would tend to push it down, but they frequently get away with it.
Right.
Yeah, so it is quite a problem for prison guards who are trying to keep cell phones out of prison, because there's prisoners who are, you know, gang leaders who are conducting their business from within the prison.
And there's really nothing beyond simply bend over and cough and let's see what happens.
Yeah. There is a very expensive chair that's a scanner, but not very many prisons have that. But there is technology, but it's quite costly, and most prisons have.
So let me ask you, just as from as an editor and a writer and someone who's interested in science, I'm always astonished at how you manage to find people, scientists who seem so far out of the mainstream. How does this happen? I mean, who are these people, and are they different from more mainstream scientists, and how do you find them? Or is it just, it's all real science?
It's all real science. There's a couple people that, you know, there's a couple people in...
Who comes to mind?
Okay, Professor Shafiq, who's now dead, but the guy who studied in Cairo, who did a tremendous number of studies on reflexes, including the reflexes of sex, and he's the one that did the delightful study about the effect of polyester on sperm count. Like, in other words, polyester is hot. Does wearing polyester underwear lower your sperm count? He actually made polyester pants for rats.
Who's wearing polyester underwear?
Rats.
People? I don't know. I'm not
in the third world. Everything's polyester in the third world. So he, I guess he was on a bit of a campaign to eradicate polyester underwear on the grounds that it is lowering sperm count. But anyway, that guy was a, was unusual in that he funds his own. I mean, it's a conservative, you know, it's a Muslim country.
Yeah, it's an unlikely place.
He would have to pay. He paid prostitutes sometimes to be subjects because he couldn't get subjects for any sort of sex related study. So anyway, he was one of those.
How about here in the U.S.? Are there when I ask you about who's the quirkiest scientist doing the quirkiest research you've ever met in the U.S.?
I guess there were a couple. There are very few universities in the U.S. that who do parapsychology. There used to be like Duke University and one of the Ivy League schools.
Harvard.
Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Harvard was doing telepathy work in the 60s. I think it was 50s, 60s. Anyway. Very, very few schools now have a parapsychology department, but University of Virginia does. So they're doing near-death experience work. They're bringing in mediums. And it's just interesting to see that going on a college campus. But after Spook came out, there was a new president that came into UVA who took Bruce Grayson, who was the researcher that I interviewed, took him aside and said, you know what, don't talk about this work anymore. They had a big endowment. That's why it had, the inventor of the Xerox machine left millions of dollars specifically for research into the persistence of personality after death.
Wow.
And so they wanted to continue receiving the endowment, but they just requested that the researcher not speak publicly about the work because it just was embarrassing.
But it's still going on, it is.
As far as I know, yeah.
What else? Anybody else doing really weird research here in the U.S.?
Weird research. There's a University of Arizona. There's a guy, Gary Schwartz, I think his name is. And he brings mediums into the facility and tests them. And he's pretty out there in terms of what you would expect to be going on at a university.
Does he have a particular theory about telepathy or something like clairvoyance?
He himself is a believer. You know, we disagreed on some of what the implications were of some of his findings, but I think he would say that he's coming at it from a perspective of neutrality. I feel like he's maybe a little bit convinced already of the outcome, but anyway, he's a lovely man, and it's interesting work.
So we only have about three minutes left, actually, but tell me, you live in Oakland, California.
Yeah.
What happened to you growing up? Why did you become this writer?
What's wrong with you?
Well, I mean, I wonder, when you talk to people and you tell them what you write about, are they fascinated? Are they grossed out? Do they walk away? What happens when you tell people about what you're writing about? Flatulence, constipation, whatever.
People are polite, so who knows what they say behind my back? And when I walk away, but usually people are ultimately when I talk a bit about the books, they end up having a lot of questions because they tend to be things that we all have questions about, but we don't really know who to ask or feel that it's appropriate to ask. Or
well, you seem to have a gift for asking questions. Not like I wouldn't think to. I think I have a lot of perverse thoughts, but I don't think I'd come up with those same questions. And if I did, I think, well, no one knows about that, right?
Yeah, right.
A lot of questions I think people have that they think, well, there's no one who knows, and you managed to find people who do know about it, is crazy to me.
I know. Like the question you asked, you were saying, like, could you have an orgasm when you die? That was, there's a woman who studies spinal cord injury and how it affects the ability to have erections, sexual arousal, and orgasm. And it depends on where on the spinal cord. I mean, this stuff is centered down in the base of the spine, the sacral nerve area. So she was a perfect person to ask. And it didn't seem strange. You know, that wasn't a strange question for her. Because that's her area. And she had...
Well, do you... I was joking, obviously, what happened to you, but in your childhood, did you have quirky interests that set you apart from your friends, or were you just a normal kid?
I think of myself as a fairly normal kid, but, you know, I often tell this story that I didn't really like dolls, but someone gave me a Barbie doll in first grade, and what I would do with it is I'd pull off the head, and I'd say, okay, I have 5 seconds to get the head back on. And right. I think about that now in terms of the context of stiff. Like, yeah, you would have about 5 seconds to get the head back on. The person could live.
Right.
So there's little glimmers.
Well, my G.I. Joe died at the stake. He was burned at the stake. So it's been great talking to you. Today's guest has been Mary Roach, whose latest book is Gulp. Let me get the subtitle here, Adventures on the Elementary Canal. So thank you very much for being here.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.